So, faith, hope, and love have been our topics of the moment. And tonight, Lewis is going to talk to us about hope. It's a pretty short chapter, actually, compared to some of the others. But as Timothy was saying a moment ago, it has some really memorable, punchy quotes in it that are fun. It was hard to know what to leave out tonight. Start off with, we'll do our little game of name that virtue. In theory, every time Lewis wants to talk about a virtue, he's real big on it's in between two extremes, one with too much and one with too little. So if hope, it's the title of the chapter, so it's going in the middle, what's the word for the absence of hope? Hopelessness? Despair? I was tempted to say pessimism, but I'm not sure that's the right word. I think despair is probably, or hopelessness are the words that I liked. Some version of that. And then what would be too much hope? I know that sounds a little silly, but what would be too much hope? Person who thinks everything's going to come out okay all the time, no matter what. Unrealistic? Huh? Obtuse? Pollyanna is actually, I almost put Pollyanna on the screen, but I didn't know if that was, suddenly now that I'm teaching Ukrainians, I keep checking all my sentences for English idioms, and I thought, is Pollyanna a word that anyone would know? I said something the other day, and the translator just stopped in mid-sentence and looked at me and said, what? Like, oh, that's something we say in Oklahoma, sorry. Pollyanna, the word I ended up with was naive, but that may be, Pollyanna might be better, or some whatever word you use for a person who just thinks it's going to work out all right no matter what. Whatever word you put on that, that'd be this. Not just an unreasonable hope, an unrealistic hope of hoping in things that cannot possibly be, right? That would be dangerous. So I think that's probably a pretty good sense of where we're at with Lewis's idea of hope. Now, interesting thing, without any really explanation at all or like doctrinal work to back it up or anything, for Lewis, Christian hope equals heaven. The end, right? That's the whole ball of wax. There's no other topic up for discussion. So you can prepare yourself when we get to the end. You can bet one of my discussion questions will be, can Christian hope refer to anything else other than, well, we go to heaven when it's over? For Lewis, that's the whole ball game. And so the entire chapter is Lewis's view of heaven, kind of masquerading under the heading of hope, because for him, they're one and the same. Not necessarily criticizing that, just saying, be aware of it, that that's all he's going to talk about. So, he says, a continual looking forward to the eternal world is not, as some modern people think, a form of escapism or wishful thinking, but one of the things a Christian is meant to do. Christian is supposed to be spending their time looking forward to the world to come. What does he mean by escapism, do you think? And is that a bad thing? What does escapism mean? Yeah, as a way to escape mentally or psychologically or emotionally your current problems. I don't want to actually deal with my problems. And so I'll just become fixated on something that may happen in the future or that I believe will happen in the future. We call that escapism. Another form of escapism is people whose kind of surreal hobbies can become escapist, where I'm going to live in a video game world or a movie world or even a book world more than the actual world, so I don't have to deal with my problems. Can Christians fall prey to that? I was thinking of it today, and I was thinking it's definitely possible. I have two songs on the screen. I'm not actually complaining about either, and I'll happily sing them both. But just as an example, when Christians say things like, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, or some glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away. You can, if you're not careful, fall into the trap of, I just don't care what's going on right now. I'm got my ticket punched. I'm out of here, right? As soon as it's over, I'm gone. And I think there's a fair point that it can become, rather than deal with the world as I see it, I'm just going to dream about something else. Is that a real problem? I think it can be. And I don't think when you look at the life of Christ, he lives that way. He sees a hungry person, he feeds a hungry person. He sees a sick person, he helps a sick person. He doesn't say, well, don't worry about it, you're going to heaven. Right? I mean, he does actually address the real, that's not the right word, the physical and material problems he sees in front of him, not just future concerns. So I would say there's a point there. Doesn't mean you have to be that way, but some people probably do fall into that trap. We'll say more about that at the end. So Lewis even acknowledges that can be a problem. He says, I must take care, on the one hand, never to despise or to be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I don't want to be dismissive. God made the world, and he put me here, and he made my body, and he made food. He made pleasure to enjoy. There are things in this life that God made, and I don't want to be so focused on heaven that I'm not grateful for what he's given me right now. That would be to miss forest for the trees, perhaps, to focus on something distant and forget what God's put right in front of you. Because on the other hand, you don't want to fall so in love with what God's given you now that you can't anticipate what he might have in store for you later. And just like everything Lewis does, it's in between two extremes. Don't be entirely fixated on what you've got now. You got to look beyond that. But also, don't ignore what you have now, because God gave you that too. Okay. In fact, he says, Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. He says, Christians that are really preoccupied with spiritual things tend to also be very kind, benevolent, helpful people. It doesn't have to be, as I say, escapism. Like, it doesn't have to be ignoring problems. People who do focus on heavenly things and the age to come and the world to come, however we want to call it, he says, they quite often do really good things. Christians kind of invented the orphanage, right? Christians go to a hospital. What hospital are you going to go to? Well, you could go to Mercy, that sounds like a Christian word, or St. John's in Tulsa, or St. Francis in Tulsa, or St. Anthony's in Oklahoma. I mean, it just seems like Christians have had a little bit of concern through the years for people's health and well-being. So focusing on heaven hasn't made us oblivious to the good things that we need to be doing in the world today. And I think he's right about that as well. He complains and says, it is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they become so ineffective in this one. And then here's one of those punchy quotes. Aim at heaven and you'll get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you'll get neither. Does the Christian, by focusing on heavenly things, learns how to act in life today? He says, but if you're completely consumed with life today, you miss everything. No one accidentally discovers God in heaven, right? But in pursuing God, you can find his creation more valuable. So aim at heaven, you get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, and you get neither. Pretty good one. Then he starts to talk about, how do I know that there is such a thing or a place as heaven? He says, most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. So he starts talking about human desire, and he says, it seems to me that we all want something and none of us seem to have it. And he says, that might ought to tell us something. He gives some examples of this. He says, the first feeling of falling in love. He talked about love a chapter ago and thought love was pretty great. But he distinguished between the feeling of love and the character trait of love. He says, but you know that first feeling of falling in love, isn't that great? When you're just swooning over someone, you know, infatuated. He says, that's wonderful. And then you end up chasing that for the rest of your life. Does it last? you don't feel like the first date forever. You can love like the first date forever, but you don't feel like the first date. It changes. It's supposed to. As Lewis said in a previous chapter, it'd be weird if it didn't. But his point is, there's part of us that wants that deep infatuation to last. Excitement of travel. He says, why do we go on holiday or go on vacation? I want to see something new, and you want to go to a new place, and you travel, and it's beautiful, and it's something different than what you're used to. Again, how long does that last? I know there's a few days at the beginning of every vacation when you say to your wife, let's move here. I want to live here forever. And then about a weekend you say, I really miss my bed. It's time to go back. Some of us it's 2 weeks, some of it's one day. But eventually the travel fever kind of wears off and you're like, yeah, okay, I've seen this place. But that feeling, that craving for beauty, no matter how beautiful it is, eventually you can't recapture the first time you see it. I love Colorado, and every time I see it, it's like the first time for me. I love mountains. But even that, if you live among them long enough, you get used to mountains. That's crazy to me, the idea that you could ever get used to mountains. But apparently, people who live in Colorado don't just walk around staring at the mountains all day. They have jobs and they go to work and do other things. So they're not like me, I guess. But they get used to it, and it's just another thing that you see. No matter how wonderful it is, you get used to it. The joy of learning. You learn something new and you figure something out and it feels really cool. It's exciting. But eventually, we all get tired of school. So, okay, I'm done, thanks. Okay, it took me longer than most, but eventually, even I got tired of school. It's like, please, no more, I'm done. And Celine said, please, no more, you're done. And that was it. One that Lewis doesn't mention that I'll add would be the pleasure of work well done. When you work really hard and do something really well, isn't that satisfying? Kind of look at something, especially if you make something. If you make something and it comes out right, yeah, that's good. It feels good. Okay, it's a great feeling. Okay, I have a table that I made for our little dining area this last month or two. I made this table, and I made it with special features so when the kids and I can play games at it, it's got like hidden features where we can play board games and stuff at this table. Okay, so every time somebody comes to the house, I say, let me show you the table I made. Okay, I don't think we've had one meal at it yet, but I show everyone that comes in, look at this table. But does it ever satisfy? Even the sensation of good work well done goes away. It's one of the first curses mentioned in Genesis to Adam. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. At first it was Adam, care and tend this beautiful garden, and then after sin enters the picture, God says, yeah, you're not going to like it very much. Thorns and thistles, sweat, and then you die. That doesn't sound very satisfying. So Lewis would say, you know, what about romance? He says, the wife may be a good wife. What about travel? The hotels and scenery may have been excellent. What about learning? Chemistry may be a very interesting job. But something has evaded us. We're never really satisfied. Why do we have to tell people to learn to be content? Because we don't get there. If everyone you met was content, we wouldn't have to explain it. Well, you should just be content with what you have. Well, we aren't. One of the smartest things an old guy ever said to me, one of my childhood heroes named Nick, was kind of a grandfather figure to me. And as I was growing up, he would give me this great advice that was in folksy Oklahoman and would not translate into Ukrainian. I can promise you that. It was always quirky and weird. But kind of like Yogi Berra, like everything he said was about half riddle. And he said, you know how much it takes to live on? A little more than you make. And that's proven true. Like, however much money you make in life, whatever your salary is, you're like, I really wish I had just a little more, then I'd be happy. And if you make less, you find a way to get by with less. And if you make more, you find a way to spend more. Right? Very rarely does anybody actually practice contentment. So he says, now there's two wrong ways of dealing with this fact and one right one. Well, of course there is, because that's the way Lewis does everything, right? Two wrong ways, one right one, right in the middle. So how are we going to deal with the fact that we're never happy about anything? He says, one way is the fool's way. He says, you can blame your object. The reason I'm not happy with food is the food isn't good enough. The reason I'm not happy with my wife isn't good enough. The reason I'm not happy with my furniture, I didn't really mean that, dear, I'm sorry. You shuffled as soon as I said that. I thought, here she comes. The reason you're not happy with your furniture is it's not good enough furniture. Not happy with your house, it's not a big enough house. Not happy with your job, it's not a good enough job. Okay, so you blame the object and say, well, clearly, I just have to find a better version of that, and then I'll be happy. Why does he call that the fool's way? It never works, right? You move on to your next wife, and she makes you happy, right? No. You move on to your next sofa, and it makes you happy. Nope. Move on to your next house, and it makes you happy. Nope. Change jobs, and it makes you happy. Nope. And so you go all through life just looking for the next thing because you think the thing is the problem. He says, that's the way of a fool. And he says, those people, he's not very nice about them. He calls them fools for a reason. He says, those people are a nuisance. It's constantly moving on to the next thing. They should quit it. He says, but the other thing is to become disillusioned and to decide, well, I'll just grow out of it. This is just the way it is. I'm supposed to sit in an uncomfortable chair, and I'm supposed to have food that doesn't taste good. I'm supposed to dislike my wife, and I'm supposed to hate my house. And that's just the way it is. Maybe young men think things get better, but old men know better. It's not supposed to be happy. Bah humbug. This is the bah humbug view of life.
Right.
And they would, instead of blaming the object, they'd blame the desires. They'd say, I shouldn't be wrong to want things. Maybe I shouldn't want anything. Maybe I shouldn't want my food to taste good. Maybe that's what's wrong with me. And so you just stop caring about anything. Lewis points out, you're less of a nuisance this way, but still not happy. Right? You keep to yourself and stop bothering people, but you're not happy at all. You're pretty miserable. And so he says, but supposing infinite happiness really is there waiting for us. Suppose one really can reach the rainbow's end. In that case, it would be a pity to find out too late, you know, like a moment after death, that by our supposed common sense, we had stifled in ourselves the faculty of enjoying it. Wouldn't it be terrible if we decided no one can ever be happy about it before we could be happy? Wouldn't that be miserable? He says, I think there's a better explanation. So, guess what? Of course, it's the middle one. He's going to say, the Christian way is this. Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. If you want something, if you crave something, that means there's something out there that could satisfy you. That's his argument. We're going to talk a long time about this one because it's interesting to me. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, typo, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. He said, instead of saying, I got to find the right thing here, and I can't, or maybe I just shouldn't want anything better, so I don't, he says, what if you want the right things, but you're looking in the wrong place? What if it's beyond this life? What if you're just not supposed to be completely happy now so that you can be perfectly happy later? This becomes a really famous apologetics argument for the existence of God. And we'll talk about it in a minute because that's my area of interest. But it's Lewis's argument from desire. And basically he says, and this is the long version, every natural desire corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. There exists in me a desire which nothing now known by human experience can satisfy. Therefore, there must exist somewhere, something more than what is known by human experience, and that something is God or life with God. Okay. Well, is that true? I read some interesting articles today of people pro and con and arguing about whether that's a good case or not. It's kind of interesting. Is this true? Is the fact that I want something mean that that thing exists? Kind of. If I want a unicorn, doesn't prove there's a unicorn. If I want to fly on a white Pegasus, doesn't mean there is a flying Pegasus for me to ride on. But it may reflect something that really is true. I want the thrill of flying through the air. That's a real thing. I want to see beauty in a fantastic creature. That's a real thing. The fact that I made up a unicorn doesn't mean that the point wasn't good. So if you don't get too specific with it, yeah, okay, usually. Anybody here hungry for Bugabaloo? Anybody have a current craving for Bugabaloo? No, because there's no such thing, I made it up. Right? You can't be really hungry for something that doesn't exist. Anybody here hungry for chocolate cake? All the time, right? Yeah, it's a real thing. Yeah, got it. Check, right? But based on the pie auction, we gathered that people are actual hungry for things that really exist, and will pay money for it. So, yeah, in general, the point's fair. You want things that you know to exist, or feel compelled to believe exist. When you feel lonely, you want companionship. Even a person who's never really had a good friend wants companionship. It's a real thing. And so that's Lewis's point, and I think it's mostly fair within boundaries. What about this one? Is this true? There exists in me a desire which nothing now known by human experience can satisfy. Is it true that nobody is happy with everything they've got? It's true that nobody's satisfied? Is there not just like a really happy human out there who doesn't believe in God, who says, I'm just satisfied with everything I got and everything's fine? Pretty much everybody in human history has said, no, I'm not that happy. If you go down through the philosophers of time, I started with Confucius. Great as the universe is, man is yet not always satisfied with it. Right? Confucius, pretty simple guy, liked simple pleasures. Yeah, still not happy. Lucretius says, while what we crave is wanting, it seems to transcend all the rest. Then when it has been gotten, we crave something else. Ancient Roman says, yeah, I just keep wanting things. And he didn't want HD television, he wanted a better toga, and yet still couldn't be happy with what he had. Augustine, as is cheating because he's a Christian, but Augustine said, seek what you seek, but not where you seek it. He says, I feel like I'm looking for the right thing, but I'm always looking in the wrong place. And then he prays to God, Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. I just can't be happy except with God. Mark, I was going to put some Jean-Paul Sartre up here as well, but I couldn't find a quote that really was punchy enough. But he was pretty miserable about everything, wasn't he? He wasn't happy about it. So all the way forward to postmodern watermelonologists, that no one's happy, my point. Nobody's really happy. Seems like a pretty fair conclusion. It's dim and grim, but it's a fair conclusion about human people. So finally then, we've been talking a lot of C.S. Lewis for 25 minutes. Is this a biblical argument? Is this just something that's fanciful that came out of Lewis's head? Or is this the kind of thing the Bible says? Does the Bible say, you have desires that this world can't satisfy, and so think of another? And the answer is the Bible does say some things that are kind of like that. I'm doing Isaiah right now with the Ukrainians, so I was reading this the other day. This is Isaiah 55:2. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. God says, you're wanting something. You're wanting, looking for it in all the wrong places. God, metaphorically, says, I could give you something that could actually make you happy. I could give you something that would actually satisfy you. How about the woman at the well? John chapter 4, they're drawing water out of the well. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water shall be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Jesus says, you want the right thing, look in the wrong place. You want water, which is why you come back every morning and get water out of this well. He says, wouldn't it be something if there was water that could make you satisfied forever? And he even calls it eternal life. Okay? Matthew 6:19-21, Sermon on the Mount. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Why not? Well, moth and rust destroy, thieves break through and steal. Okay? Things you got now, it's hard to be happy with them. They fall apart or somebody takes them. But lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Why? Well, moth doesn't destroy it, rust doesn't destroy it, thieves don't break in and steal it. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There's something better to want, and he says it's a heavenly thing to want. Earthly things are going to disappoint you. Heavenly desires would be better. Sounds pretty biblical to me. And then here's one from 2 Corinthians 5, 1 through 5. We know that the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed. We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared for us this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. What's the tent he's referring to? Yeah, your body. Here, Paul's a tent maker, so he likes this reference. He says, right now I've got a tent. It's not a bad tent, but it's a tent. It's a temporary tent. It's a tent that gets me by for now. He says, but I'm anticipating something better. And I think God will give me something better. He says, when I die, I don't lose my tent. He says, I gain a home. We fear when we die, well, I leave the body and I'm done and there's nothing left of me. He says, no. He says, read that again. Not that we should be unclothed, but that we should be further clothed, right? He says, we're not trading in something bad for something worse. He says, when a believer dies, he's trading in something temporary for something better. Amen. Sounds kind of like the point Lewis wants us to take away from his point on hope. Finally, at the end of the chapter, and then I'll have more to say about this, but I wanted to wrap this up because I thought it was funny, really funny. He says, is heaven language literal? Is it silly? He says, is it absurd to think about everybody's going to be on a cloud with a harp? What if I don't like harps? I know. Sky says, what's wrong with a good harp? But, you know, so not everybody's a musician. I've heard people say that. Are we just going to sing all the time in heaven? What if I don't like singing? How literal are you supposed to take it? Okay? Because even if it's a street of gold, remember what I said about mountains? Eventually you get tired of mountains. Would you eventually get bored with a gold street? Is it literal? Is it silly? Lewis says, there's no need to be worried by I can't even say that word. Someone say facetious. I always try to say fastidious, and it's not a word either. Facetious people who try to make the Christian hope of heaven ridiculous by saying they do not want to spend eternity playing harps. See, Sky, he's okay. He's with the music too. And then he drops this one-liner that made me LOL pretty hard. He says, the answer to such people is that if they cannot understand books written for grown-ups, they should not talk about them. Curl up a little bit. He says, Christians, no, we're not talking about a literal harp, that we're not playing arpeggios throughout all eternity. It's clearly more than that. He says, if you can't read a grown-up book, be quiet and let the grown-ups talk for a while. He's like really smart aleck in that sentence, and I kind of love it. Because that's the way you feel sometimes when people like find some deep contradiction about Christianity, and you're like, really? Can you read? I mean, there are some really good Christian questions. It's not the ones on the internet. This one's really lame. And he says, that's just a lame question. Be quiet, let the grown-ups talk a lot. And I thought that was pretty funny. People who take these symbols literally might as well think that when Christ told us to be like doves, he meant that we should lay eggs. And that's actually the last sentence of the chapter. He just drops the mic after that, and he says, that's just dumb. Next chapter. So that's his take on heaven and hope. With about 10 minutes before I open it up for discussion, I did want to throw in some more recent criticisms or views about Lewis and heaven and so forth that have become popular and interesting, and I think raise some good questions. A couple of years back, one of my favorite New Testament scholars, N.T. Wright, wrote an article called Simply Lewis, where he talked about all the great things he loves about C.S. Lewis. It's a long article because there's a lot of stuff he loves about C.S. Lewis. But then he said, there's one thing about Lewis I just don't get. And oddly enough, it's this chapter. And so I thought I would just share his comments on it. He says, I find Lewis frustratingly fuzzy on heaven and immortality. He clearly believes in the bodily resurrection and the essential materiality of the ultimate future world, but quite apart from the astonishing fact that in talking about Jesus, he never in this book mentions his resurrection, he persistently refers to heaven in ways that go, to my mind, far too far towards Plato. His complaint is, Plato thought of everything was like these perfect ideas just floating in the sky. And he says, sometimes it feels like Lewis just thinks we're going to be like little balls of light floating around numbers and math equations in the sky and this perfect world of ideas. And he says, I just don't get that. And his big point, I think, is just a home run. When I first read this, I went back and reread Mere Christianity. And sure enough, nowhere in Mere Christianity does Lewis ever talk about the idea of resurrection, the idea of a body. It's just, you're here and then you're up there. And he kind of skips that in-between step, which a lot of Christians do. We're here, then we're up there. And yet the doctrine of the resurrection is kind of a big deal. Like, it's the whole gospel. He died and then was raised from the dead. And then what happens to you? You die and then you skip that part. Well, you're raised from the dead and something happens, right? So apparently it's a big deal. And N.T. Wright is really frustrated that Lewis just somehow does the whole bit and never talks about it. He goes on. He tells us that if we aim at heaven, we'll get earth thrown in. We like that quote. And this is not only true, but appealing. But he never indicates how this works out. Never engages with the New Testament's picture of the new heavens and new earth, for example, which ultimately makes sense of the whole thing. I simply don't think this is either biblical or helpful. And I fear that those who read Lewis will at this point have their traditional expectations reinforced, or they should have had them undermined. He says, he tells you kind of what you want to hear. We're all going to float off in a cloud. And he said, no. Lewis was a literature guy, and he writes a New Testament guy. And so he says, you know, there's more in the New Testament than just floating around on a cloud. In fact, floating around on a cloud is actually kind of hard to find in the New Testament. What's really easy to find in the New Testament is you're going to be resurrected from the dead. And so he would want us to say, what if both of these things had a point and Lewis kind of missed it? What if there's something wrong with the things we desire and there's something wrong with our desires and God intends to fix both of those things in the resurrection? That would be Wright's view of it. I'll skip a bit for sake of time. Here's Romans 8, which is Wright's like favorite passage of all time. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us. Okay, so again, we're agreeing something better lies ahead. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. The creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. That section right there, that's not talking about we're going to go somewhere else. That sentence says God is going to fix what's broken. That's a little different spin on it than just like escapism. I'm going to leave here and go someplace better. He says, you know, the world's pretty messed up and God's going to fix it. I don't know what that means, but Paul seems to think it's important, and he's not even done. We know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth unto now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we await eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. The resurrection, you're not coming back as Casper. Your body is going to be fixed. There's a resurrection from the dead. And that means something more than just, again, kind of floating around in the sky. And that's interesting. For in this hope we are saved. This is, for Paul, that's what we hope for. It's not something secondary. Hope that is seen is not hope. Who hopes for what he sees? If we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Do you see it now? No. But we wait for a day when God fixes things. And that's a different spin on it. And I'll give you one other New Testament passage that does this. That's the Old Testament. I'm going to skip a bit. I'm on an Isaiah kick right now. Let me go to 2 Peter. 2 Peter 3. The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and the heavens will pass away with a roar. The heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved. The earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Okay, everybody with me so far? Christ comes back, heaven burns, earth burns, then what? Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought we to you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn? But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Okay. What we got burns, but we're not floating around in nothingness. He says there's someplace new to go. And what does he call it? Well, new heaven, new earth. Okay. Well, that's a little different than we're used to. My thought is we probably need to think about both. If you only think about the life to come as I'm going to float away on a cloud, get really fixated on that and don't worry about your current situation. Do I need to help somebody with a disease if we're all going to float away later? No, you die, we're all heading off to heaven, don't worry about it. Right? I'm going on vacation. On the other hand, if you get completely focused on God's going to fix this world the way it is, and I need to fix this world the way it is, you get so wrapped up in current world problems that it's hard to look any further. That there might be some problems you can't fix now, there might be some things that we have to wait, and it really is a new heaven and new earth, not the same heaven and same earth. That makes sense? Like we're going somewhere better. It'll be a little bit like earth, because you'll be there. That's been my long-standing explanation when somebody says, what's a new heaven and new earth means? Well, it's not like current heaven, because you'll be there. Right? Current heaven, you're not invited. New heaven, you're invited. And it's not like current earth, because God will be there. Current earth, we don't let God come down here. Too much sin. New earth, God's there with us. So there's a place where humans and God live forever. Some passages call that heaven. Some places call that new heaven, new earth. But whatever you call it, the point is, it's something better that's waiting us in the world to come, when the body is raised and we're prepared to be with God forever. Which is why when I preach on heaven, you'll always hear me say the same thing. Don't worry about the geography so much. If God was in Kentucky, that would be heaven, right? The point is to go be with God. And so the Bible gives you just a dizzying array of pictures to give you the sense of there's another place and it's better. And it's where God is. Even the book of Revelation, there's a city four square and it has one street. Think about that one a minute. A square, draw a map, draw a square city and only draw one street in it. There's a lot of people who can't get across to the other side of town. That doesn't make any sense at all. Well, it's not supposed to be a literal town with a literal plot map and a literal street, right? Also, gold would make a terrible street. There's a reason we don't do that, besides the expense. You're not supposed to take it literal, which was Lewis's point all along, right? Don't get carried away with that. The point is, it's something better than you've got. In fact, it's something worth desiring. Okay? I'm going to preach on this in a few weeks, not soon, but in a few weeks, and look at a couple of these passages, because I'm curious about them. I won't be quoting C.S. Lewis, but we'll look at some of the New Testament passages, because I think it's important to think about what does God want us to dream about when he talks about the world to come. But for now, I promised time for discussion. So here's my questions about this chapter. Number one, did we ever actually talk about hope in the chapter on hope? He gets really quickly fixated on the idea of heaven, which is great. I hope for heaven too. But he never actually tells us, so what is hope? So one of you might want to say, here's my definition of hope. That would be good. Lewis kind of skipped that part. And you understand why? Because he's really excited about heaven. And that's all he wanted to talk about. Is life in the world to come the only kind of hope Christians can talk about? So when we talk about hope, do we mean heaven? I mean, that is the only hope Christians have. Is there anything else we hope for as a Christian? Good question, I thought. How about this? The Old Testament very rarely talks about going to heaven. Like you can find four or five passages at most that talk about the idea of a heaven forever kind of place. Did they not have any hope? What did they hope for? If you're the prophet Isaiah, for example, and you don't talk about going to heaven, what did he hope God would do? And then what do you think of the heaven versus new heaven, new earth discussion? Is that a mountain out of a molehill? Do you care? Is it interesting? We want to talk about the Jehovah's Witnesses or not. That's another sermon for another day, probably. Anyway, what'd you think of Hope? I'm curious what you thought of that dizzyingly beautiful and frustrating chapter.